mahram and non-mahram things automatically, because they are getting this, society, they are getting this atmosphere at home in the society, so it's easy for them. But, in other societies, unfortunately, they do not have this atmosphere for the sons also, for the daughters. So it's very difficult for them to practice.
Environment counts a lot. Environment can make the duty is very easy or very challengeable. And therefore, Islam is emphasizing a lot on Amr bi Ma'roof. Like, you have to encourage, invite others towards good deeds and towards goodness. Why? Because, automatically, I remember when I was so young in Iran, every area has a beautiful mosque and, Islamic center. So the mothers, they usually take their young girls with beautiful white chador and they're just sitting and praying with mothers, Now, day by day, it's getting still, mashallah,
an Islamic society. Even if we are living in West, means if you have a circle of friends, Muslim friends, you make a circle and only you go to each other's house and invite them and go together.
We have to live in our Muslim bubble.
So like this, they can provide a society, they can keep their children away from all those, not healthy things of, the Western societies. Although it's difficult, but still it is possible. And we have seen so many families, how they are providing good atmosphere to their children.
Exactly. There are so many challenges, but if you have a very strong, home environment, if your team is so strong, like our team means parents, our children, our some friends and relatives, whoever is according to your mind, mind matching. So if you make a team, then you can easily face the challenges.
Especially
of that
the
area.
Role of mother is very, very essential here.
Exactly.
If mother
Muslim
wants
lady,
a Muslim lady, and mother will have a good role when she, as our daughter, she gets all these things, all these respect. So alhamdulillah, thank you so much. Even I myself have taken so much knowledge from your discussions. And I'm sure our dear listeners also, they are also having so many benefits from these talks.
We all are students of Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. And, I have a special, connection with sayings of Masumin alayhimus salam. I love hadith. And I thoroughly enjoy to discuss.
Sorry to disturb
in
again. This time is not permitting us to talk more. So inshallah, we will meet in our next episode. Until then, fi amanillah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
فَقَدْ قَالَ اللَّهُ الْحَكِيمُ فِي كِتَابِهِ الْمُبِينِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْتَرِي لَهْوَ الْحَدِيثِ لِيُذِلَّ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ وَيَتَّخِذَهَا هُزُوًا أُولَٰئِكَ لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ مُحِينٌ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ. My dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are looking at the theme of dealing with temporal strife through living a Quranic life. How to understand the challenges that you and I face in this world, this upside down world that we live in, where things, as much as we think, you know, that things are going normal, that things get turned upside down for us, as we see happening with COVID-19 around the world today. How do we deal with such difficulties and even the personal challenges that we face within our lives? In this series, we've been wanting to look at all of the different, or look at many of the difficulties rather that we face, and to draw inspiration from Kalamullah, the noble Quran, the words of Allah, of how we can deal with the difficulties in our lives. To realize that this book of Allah is not just a book to read in beginning of a majlis, or at a funeral, or at a wedding, or in special occasions, but rather that we as believers begin to take an active role in reading and reflecting and understanding and trying to implement the ayat of the Quran in our daily lives. Because as we said from the very first night, that this book contains answers for all of our problems. We just need to look at the book in the right way, with the right vision, with the right understanding, and we will get the answers that we are searching for in life. Tonight, we look at our topic of entertainment, the Quranic perspective on permissible and impermissible. The verse which I began with comes to us from a very beautiful chapter of the Quran known as Surah Luqman, chapter number 31, verse number 6. Now, let me just mention one or two things about Luqman. He's a very interesting character if you get a chance to study about him. He was, as we have been told in the hadith, a man from Africa. He was given an opportunity by Allah to either take nubuwa, prophethood, or hikmah, wisdom, to become a wise man. And he passed up the opportunity for nubuwa, and he was given this level of hikmah. And Allah makes note of this even in the Quran, where he says, وَلَكَدْ أَتَيْنَا لُقْمَانَ Al-Hikmah, that Allah says that we have given Luqman wisdom, hikmah. And the chapter, actually a very beautiful chapter, again it's a discussion that he has with his young son, where he gives his son lots of advice on how to live life. And it shows us even as believers, and especially as parents, as the fathers who are watching tonight, the role of a father in upbringing his children. The way that he talks to his son, the advice that he gives him, the discussions that he has with his young child. In one of the verses, in verse number 6, Allah gives forth this very important commandment for us. Let me first go into why this verse was revealed. As we know that the Quran, the ayat, come down for certain reasons. Things were happening in Mecca or in Medina, which necessitated Allah to reveal ayat to the Prophet, to explain the situation further for the community. So we're told that there was an individual in Medina who was a believer, and he was apparently a Muslim, and he went out and he bought a slave girl as a woman that would be in his house to provide entertainment as a singer, as a dancer. Obviously, they didn't have, you know, television and the things like that that we have today. And so you would go in the market, and yes, slavery existed at the time of the Prophet. It was a slow eradication, a slow process to eradicate it. So he purchases a slave woman from the market, and her responsibility was to provide entertainment at home, to sing, to dance for him. And this obviously is something which not only is haram, and we look at that in our discussion tonight about certain issues about the permissible and impermissible. But this was something obviously that was keeping him away from the remembrance of Allah, as entertainment many times does even to you and I today. And so this verse comes down to Rasulullah, which says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ, and of the people, مَنْ يَشْتَرِي لَحْوَ الْحَدِيثِ لِيُذِلَّ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. And amongst the people is somebody who purchases this idle talk, this diversionary talk, which leads people astray from the Quran, from Allah, from all things holy. So they are purchasing, they are using money, they are going forth and expending time and resources to misguide, not only themselves, but other people from the path of Allah. بِغَيْرِ إِلْمٍ وَيَتَّخِذَهَا هُزُوًا, that they take the Quran for mockery, as a joke. أُولَٰئِكَ لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ, Allah says for them is a shameful, humiliating punishment. So this verse comes down to show the Prophet and the believers that look, this diversionary tactic that is being used of entertainment, of pleasure, this was something which was looked very badly upon by Allah within the Quran, and the believers were made known in those days that, you know what, that this act of going towards the prohibited, to misguide people, to distance people from Allah, that this is something which is not allowed in Islam. It has consequences, it has ramifications, and it also has obviously a punishment in the world to come. Now with that, let me go into the introduction for tonight. And it's a very vast discussion. I'm going to try and keep it very focused for tonight. But you know, we live in a society today, especially brothers and sisters, where from before our birth all the way up until our death, we are surrounded by enjoyment, pleasure, fun, entertainment. You know, if you think about it, we have the hadith that Rasulullah says, seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave. Today, that rather than seeking knowledge, talibul ilm, utlubul ilm min al-mahdi ila lahad, people are seeking entertainment from the cradle to the grave. What do I mean? Well, you look at the society that we live in today, and when a woman is pregnant with her children, with her child, many times you'll see this on, and you'll read this in news articles, or you'll see it on television, that the mother will, for example, sing songs to the baby. The mother will be on her tablet or her phone or on television, watching things on the internet, and they're forms of entertainment for her, but the child in the womb is taking this information in. You may think, well, that's preposterous. How does the fetus that's still developing at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months in the womb, how can it actually react or understand things around it that is outside of its world that it's contained in? And this is a reality that you can look it up online, that you know, the fetus does respond to outside stimulus. And that's why we're told in Islam for mothers that you have to be extra careful when you're pregnant of what you look at, what you listen to, what you eat, where you go, because all of these have an impact on the child. So, as I said, that we begin as a society that is steeped in fun, in pleasure, in entertainment, from pre-birth until we're born. Then, you know, we have stores like Babies R Us, like Toys R Us. Our children get caught up in games as a child, as a baby, as an infant, and they grow and they continue in that way. And as they get older, their toys get a bit more advanced, as we spoke about yesterday. And this continues all the way until we die. We're always surrounded by fun, by pleasure. You go shopping, you go into the mall, you go into the store, there is music playing. You go in an elevator, there is music playing. You go anywhere today, at school, at work, there's always some form of fun or entertainment or music to keep us busy in different ways. So we're not saying that we cut out entertainment from our lives. No, we're saying that we need to understand what is permissible. Why is it permissible? We have to understand what is haram, what is impermissible. Why is it impermissible?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Qamusul Rijal starts with an introduction, and in this introduction there are 28 chapters in which different ideas that late Allama Tustari had in Ilm al-Rijal are mentioned in this introduction.
Allama Shushtari, since he was really interested in this field of study, when he was reading the book Tanqih al-Maqal, he had his specific comments on the views of Allama Mamaqani, the author of the book and Tanqih al-Maqal.
Ourselves, we strayed from Al-Mu'annim. Surely we've wronged ourselves. What will we say?
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you. Truly you are our teacher.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and scholars all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah to you and to your dear listeners.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding figure who was one of the contemporary Shia Rijal scholars. Of course, we will talk what is Rijal and what is this field of study. He is no one but Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari. Okay, Sheikh Mahtabi, let's start with you, Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, and his early life. What information do we have about him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari is born to a family of knowledge, and he is born in Najaf in 1903, and then moved to Iran when he was 7 years old. But after he studied for some years in Iran in opposition to the law of Kashf Hijab being issued by Reza Shah.
Yes.
Actually, the first Pahlavi Shah of Iran being under the dominance of yes. British Empire.
You mean forced unveiling of the women in Iran at that time by the order of
yes, it yes. was issued.
Yes.
Okay, in opposition to this movement, he left Iran and went back to Atabat Aliyat, stayed there for 7 years or 6 years, as he mentions in his biography. And when he was there, he started offering his outstanding work, Qamus al-Rijal. Mm-hmm. And yes. after that, he went back to Iran and stayed in Shushtar.
Yes.
This is very important to pay attention to. He was a really great scholar, but he stayed in Shushtar. Although we know we had a very great scholars
yes.
coming from Shushtar, naming Sheikh Ansari, every student of seminary school yes. is familiar with the personality of Sheikh Ansari. He belongs to the city of Shushtar.
Sheikh al-Akbar, you mean? Sheikh Ansari.
Sheikh al-A'zam.
A'zam or Akbar, yes, that's right. Yes. And where is Shushtar?
Shushtar is a north city of the province of Khuzestan.
Uh-huh. It's in the southern Iran.
Yes.
So it is not originally belonging to any famous house or something, no? I mean, it is not famous like Qom, Mashhad, or
definitely.
Najaf.
Okay. Yeah, that is yeah. just, you can give it a try. You ask the students of Hausa, just name some well-known cities of the knowledge mm-hmm. of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
First, they may call Qom or Najaf, and they may refer to Mashhad, yes. even Isfahan.
Yes.
But barely they may consider Shushtar mm-hmm. as one of the cities of knowledge of Ahlul Bayt.
That's right.
So I was just mentioning this point that out of having a very simple life, avoiding fame, he stayed in Shushtar until the end of his life. Mm-hmm. He actually was residing in Shushtar, although he had some trips and going to Iraq, coming to Qom and other cities and staying for a short period of time. But mainly he resided in Shushtar, and finally he passed away there in year 1995 and buried in Shushtar.
That's all right.
Yeah.
You know, in the past and also in the present time, some of the ulama who are studying in the city of Najaf, Qom or Mashhad, when they are done and they receive, we can say, the permission of Ijtihad, they get back to their homeland because they believe that we have to be useful for the, we can say, the people of that region. Although it must be a village or a very small town in Iran or in Iraq or any part of the Muslim land, they get back over there and are the source of benefits, you know, for the people over there. This is, I think, a really beautiful habit that some of the ulama, especially in the past generation, it was more than now. We can say the people got back to their homeland and has been over there preaching Islam, answering the religious questions of the people over there, having a very simple life. And the people around could see an alim living among them, okay? Or being busy with a scholar life in the same city that he was born. This is, I think, really appreciable by the side of some of the scholars, including Muhammad Taghi Shushtari. Okay, Sheikh Ziaini, let's get to you, brother. What other information do we have about the scholarly life and the education of Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The late Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, or At-Tustari, is a well-known figure among Islamic scholars that dedicated his life for different, you know, well-known works, like Qamus al-Rijal, and also like the book Bahj al-Sabagha fi Sharh Nahj al-Balagha, that we may discuss about these works inshallah later. You know, he was amongst those figures that beside studying and compiling books, as you mentioned, he was living amongst people.
Yes.
And he decided to settle in Shushtar. And this is, as you mentioned, was a seerah of ulama, of scholars. For example, Marhum Ashikh Abdul Karim Al-Ha'iri, when he returned to Iran, he didn't move to Qom.
Yes.
He went to Iraq and settled there.
Yes.
And as a result of the invitation of the scholars of Qom, he decided to come to Qom. Or late Marhum Ayatollah Burujerdi, rahmatullah alayhi, he himself didn't come to Qom directly from Najaf. As a result of the invitation of the scholars in Qom, he decided to come to Qom.
Also the late Mazandarani, I think, in the northern Iran, who
many different
at the
scholars.
Time of Sheikh Ansari, because when they referred to Sheikh Ansari to select him as the Zaim of Hawza of Najaf, they said refer to that man, okay?
Yeah.
But that man was living in Iran, in the northern part of Iran, in the villages, but higher in education, as Sheikh Ansari himself believed.
Yeah.
This was, as I said, a very beautiful custom and habit among them.
And late Marhum Tostari had really a humble life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was avoiding to be in a materialistic life as the seat of scholars and ulama is like this. For example, I quote from some of the scholars that I have heard from them that when he wanted to publish his books, he used to come to Tehran or Qom to visit some scholars. And he had some, you know, papers with himself, you know, a bunch of papers. And he was telling them, okay, this is my new works. You search and take a look on it.
Yes.
And maybe it's useful. If
yes.
you find it useful, you may publish it.
Okay.
So he was not, you know, counting himself as a noble scholar that
yes.
every person must refer to.
Yes.
And he, you know, himself was trying to broadcast the call of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam.
This khuzu and khushu.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, besides having, you know, this type of life, after his demise even, people are, you know, because they were familiar with his personality. Nowadays, his tomb in Shushtar is a place that people are gathering in the day of Ashura to have a procession and
yes.
to have the demonstration there. And you know that he wrote in his will that all of his books are given to the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam, but these books must not, you know, taken out from his house. So now that house is its building and all, you know, the furniture of the house are belonging to the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam, but it's a library.
That's all right.
And museum. People are referring to that library. It's, you know, useful for them.
Okay.
And, you know, even after his life, his house and his properties are benefiting people.
That's all right.
Of Shushtar.
Sheikh Mahtavi, Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, or as is known of Allama, Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, is known because of his work in the field of Rijal, okay? Some of our dear listeners might not be familiar with this field of study. What does it mean by Rijal, and what is it concerned about?
This is a very good question. Elmur Rijal, or if we wanted to translate it into English, we have to say the science of narrators is considered out of one of the very important knowledges that, or sciences that every student of, or every mujtahid is relying on in order to differentiate or distinguish between the trustworthy narration and fabricated narrations.
Definitely.
So it's got a very high position in terms of reaching the level of ijtihad. And it can support all Muslim or all believers in order to defend from their religion, because sometimes we might be accused of holding faith into the religion that has been transmitted through narrators that we have no knowledge about the their level of knowledge, their authenticity.
Yes.
So through science of narrators or Elmur Rijal, we are presenting the process in which a mujtahid or the scholar can distinguish between the fake narrations, fabricated narrations, and genuine one.
So the Rijal here means the narrator of ahadith, isn't it?
Yes, it concerns with biography and everything which is related to the personality of narrators of ahadith or narrations.
Right. Okay.
So this is a very important thing that our audience must take into consideration before we deal with this personality.
That's all right. So different scholars like Muhammad Taghi Shushtari tried in order to differentiate or distinguish between authentic and the non-authentic narrators of ahadith, is it?
It's better to say one of his works is dedicated to this field of study.
But he's known with this work, I mean, Qamus al-Rijal.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. He had this expertise to differentiate between the different narrators. Right. Yes.
Any other benefit for the students who are interested in Rijal, Sheikh Ziyaniyah? Do you think that it is a must for the Islamic students of the houses to be familiar with this field of study? Do you think it's useful for them?
For sure. You know, if a person wants to get benefit from the Islamic resources, he needs to get benefit from the reliable ones.
Yes.
And authentic ones. So if you want to use the authentic resources, you need to know them. And how we can know these resources? Through Ilm al-Rijal. So if you want to, for example, in Ilm al-Fiqh, you want to give fatwa in accordance with a riwayat, you need to know the narrators and to distinguish and distinct between the authentic one and non-authentic ones. So Ilm al-Rijal is useful in this regard. And also, if even in history,
that's right.
Ilm al-Rijal is useful. So you may get, you know, you may distinct between the books and the writers that have compiled, you know, weak riwayat and narrations, and those ones who have compiled and, you know, gathered authentic ones.
That's right.
So it's a tool for a scholar who wants to do research regarding Islamic studies.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyaniyah. And Sheikh Mahdavi, and finally, Allama Shushtari passed away in 1416, according to the Hijra calendar, 19th day of the month of Zulhijjah. You know, and he was, as Sheikh Mahdavi also said, he was buried in the city of Shushtar, the place that he belonged to. His library is over there, his tomb is over there. He lived for 96 years, a very fruitful life, and, you know, compiled one of the most outstanding work in the field of Rijal study, that is Qamus al-Rijal. We will talk about Qamus al-Rijal in our upcoming session of the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you, Sheikh Ziyaniyah and Sheikh Mahdavi.
You are most welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Do not forget to visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries. So let's start spinning this show.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasojan Parsemehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day. Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines to work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threads.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threads are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
Polyester has gained a significant role in the textile industry. Some 50 years ago, cotton was the most important fiber in this industry. But over the years, this changed. Population growth meant prioritizing food crops, which decreased the area for cotton cultivation. So demand for polyester fibers grew such that it is now called the king of fibers in the textile industry.
At present, the most important raw material in the textile industry is polyester. It dominates 60% of material used in the textile production cycle. This is followed by cotton and then a small amount of other natural fibers, such as wool and silk. Other synthetic fibers, such as acrylic, nylon, and polypropylene, are also used in this industry, among others. The main raw material used to make polyester threads are granules, which are produced in large amounts in the petrochemical industry. Domestic polyester granule production is dominated by a handful of companies with a combined annual production of over 420,000 tons. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. This amount is largely set for the making of polyester threads and is said to be enough for domestic needs. The petrochemical industry also produces other granules, which are used across almost all industrial sectors. Last year, Iran's total thread production stood at around 48,000 tons. 25% of the raw material used in this production was from cotton. That's based on figures from the National Textile Association.
The country makes a lot of cotton, but it is still not nearly enough to meet demands. The domestic demand is roughly around 120,000 tons of cotton annually. This is why local productions last year stood at around 60,000 tons.
Polyester is derived from polymers made by the petrochemical industry. It's not surprising that Iran's polymer industry is exponentially expanding given its large oil reserves. Various manufacturing sectors, such as the textile industry, plastics, and even automobile industry, are heavily dependent on petrochemical products. So how are productions in this sector doing?
Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. That's based on statistics from the National Plastics and Polymer Industrial Association. Of this amount, some 3 million tons of raw material are exported with a value of $3 billion. The other half of total productions is domestically used to make added value products. These items include polyester string, fabrics, tires, dishes, and containers, and a whole lot more. In total, the association puts the combined exports of petrochemical and polymer products at around $12 billion. Iran's Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union predicts an increase in added value of petrochemical products. The union estimates products made from petchems will reach a value of $18 billion in exports by the end of this year. The government has implemented policies and initiatives to increase added value through industries that use these raw materials. All in all, there are numerous opportunities in this sector and the ever-growing textile industry. It is an industry that has built a bridge between past and present with an eye on the future.
It's now time for my colleague on the field to take over the show and teach us all something new. Take it away.
Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, springs began being mass-produced around the turn of the 19th century, paving the way for quick and innovative advancement. An improvement in the production of steel meant that it could be made relatively cheaper, allowing the usage of springs to expand at a rapid pace.
In our day-to-day lives, we use a lot of products that utilize springs to achieve their desired motion. What I can think of on the spot are the tiny springs we see in our pens and biros. Now, springs, because of their variety, are also a perfect example of how materials can be manipulated for different applications.
Sazeh Fanarpuyesh is one of the big production companies in Iran that specializes in spring manufacturing. The rise of computer-aided design and drafting has made custom-made creations and cutting down on time, energy, and waste possible. The same CAD software that can be used to design springs big enough to support entire buildings through an earthquake can also create 30 micrometer-sized versions for medical use.
A variety of CNC spring machines are used to manufacture extension springs. Now, typically, we use springs to apply an opposing force wherever we need it. Now, in these machines, by making slight adjustments, you can create springs with different tensions in line with the customer's requirements.
Variable factors, including wire composition, coil diameter, and the amount of external force, can be changed and calculated automatically to allow designers to come up with suitable, cost- and time-efficient manufacturing designs. The coil spring manufacturing process involves feeding a wire into a set of rollers that pull the spring wire into the wire guides. The said wire then comes into contact with a coiling point that coils the wire backwards, forming a pigtail. New discoveries, such as how heat treatment strengthens certain ferrous metals and alloys after being coiled, allows numerous industries to expand a spring's application.
treatment oven, and it's the standard equipment in most metalworking facilities. Now, what happens is that springs go into this oven and they are heated to an optimal temperature, and then the cooling process is completely controlled. This helps relieve the stress of the springs. Therefore, it's quite natural that sometimes they are referred to as stress relieving ovens.
Although a spring may seem like a minor component within a large device, functional failure of the spring could result in a device's complete malfunction. Since many products rely on the durability of their springs, it is crucial to select high-quality ones that will not fail prematurely.
Typically, springs are tested to ensure their performance. For example, the device we have to my left is a spring fatigue testing machine that measures a spring's ability to withstand forces in a loading cycle. And the one you have behind me ensures the power of a spring, that the spring can deliver what it says it will. And of course, the device is a salt spray testing device that actually tests the durability of the spring's coating.
Protective coatings are often the most cost-effective method to prolong spring life in corrosive environments. Spring versatility suggests that the manufacture and use of spring technology isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
Past few decades, the demand for minuscule springs has risen dramatically because of their use in mobile phones, touchpads, and of course other modern electronic devices. So even after thousands of years of evolution, spring technology could have a future that's completely different to what it is today. Who knows, maybe even 4D printing and 2D materials will play a hand in it.
Thank you for that amazing reporting. We're just about out of time, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the textile industry. Ever wanted a pair of socks that remain odor-free? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company which specializes in making nanotextiles has been producing them for years and is now exporting this product.
This company makes a special textile used in these socks, which is antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-odor. This product was mainly produced for diabetic patients who are susceptible to foot ulcers. Recently, this company began exporting its nano socks to neighboring countries as well as European states. Last year, some 8,000 pairs of these advanced socks were exported to Britain alone. Iran has made big advancements in the field of nanotechnology and is ranked fourth in the world for its high-quality nanotech products.
As you know, sportswear is a hot topic as many people are aiming to reach their fitness goals and stay healthy. Now, a special type of fabric has been created for the first time in Iran, which has cooling properties and is used to make activewear.
An Iranian knowledge-based company used nanotechnology to produce nylon fabrics that cool down the body by reflecting infrared radiation. These nanocomposite fabrics have many functions, including eliminating odors, rapid drying, and increasing blood circulation. The product received nanoscale certification from the National Headquarters of Nanotech Development 2 years ago. It is now part of the Healthex fabric collection manufactured at this nano company.
Silk thread produced in Iran has been used to make clothing fabric and for weaving Persian rugs for millennia. And ancient methods of silk making are still alive among many village communities across Iran.
Traditional silk makers are mainly located in northern Gilan and northeastern Khorasan Razavi provinces. These communities make a living off of this trade the same way their ancestors did some 3,000 years ago. They get their silk cocoons in wooden boxes, mainly from the northern provinces. The cocoons are soaked in hot water to loosen the filaments. Then the threads are hand spun around spindles. It's a labor-intensive process that can take up to 12 hours to produce 1 kilogram of this valuable thread. While this process has become fully mechanized in many factories, traditional spinning methods still continue in these villages. These activities also offer interesting attractions for tourists.
And that covers our program for today. Let us know what you think about this industry by dropping us a line via email. Also, thank you so much for all the feedback on our Instagram page. Thank you for tuning in.
وما ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen wa Sayyid al-Muwahideen Aliyan alayhi salam. Among the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen worked on handily is the fact that he wanted to establish an economical justice in the Muslim society, or for those who were under his control, under his power, under his government, to say the least. Before we say this, it's good to mention that the 25 years that preceded Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah alayhi, it witnessed a cancerous growth when it came to economy in the Muslim world, to such an extent that there were some who pretty much took over everything, and only little few of the Muslims were in power in the in types, in forms of economy, while the rest of the Muslims, they had nothing. So he came at a time where this division between people in terms of economy was huge. The gap between those who are rich and those who are poor was way too much. So he came to fix something that has been there for over 25 years. And some of the rights of the Muslims were taken. Their lands were taken. Their money was taken. I don't know, they were charged way too much taxes than that they shouldn't have to pay to begin with. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he came, and when he looks at wealth, he says, فَجُنَاتِ أَيْدِيهِمْ لَا تَكُنْ لَغَيْرِ أَفَّاهِهِمْ. Those who work for themselves, they have to feed themselves. They shouldn't be working for other people, giving their money to other people. That should not happen. And then, among the first thing that he worked on to establish that equity, to establish that equality when it comes to economy, is the fact that he asked people to give back the money they've taken from others, or whether it's land or wealth, that has to be given to them. That was one of his first approaches to make this gap between those who are rich and those who are poor to minimum. To the extent he said, "Inna fil adli si'a." When it comes to justice, there's a lot of space. وَمَنْ ضَاقَ عَلَيْهِ الْعَدْلِ, and those who see that justice is too narrow for them, then الْجَوْرَ عَلَيْهِمْ أَضْيَقُ, oppression is more tighter and more narrower than justice. Because he's trying to highlight that a lot of people weren't happy with what Amir al-Mu'mineen was doing. They said, well, why should I give back the money that I have, the lands that I have? He said to them, it's simple, because it's not yours. Justice needs to be applied. You need to give back what you've taken from people. And that was a very harsh concept for them. And then he went and he had to speak out his heart. He had to